is pretty irrelevant because the title was always just going to be a random collection of buzzwords that lets me talk about what I want to talk about. Yeah, all these buzzwords basically surround the same topic. So I'm going to talk about measurements. I'm going to talk about what physical information is, what quantum information is, why information is a very natural way to think about the way quantum mechanics is structured. And I'm going to talk about teleportation in some detail because I think the details of teleportation really bring out the information theoretic structure of quantum theory. But before I start, usual disclaimers. Ask questions, interrupt at your leisure. Monday morning is not my favorite time of the week, so the chances of me rambling incoherently at some stage during the talk are quite high. So if you want to point that out, feel free. There are really two reasons I'm giving this talk, specifically on information and teleportation. Information is just general information. The reason I'm talking about information is it's my hobby horse, so give me an opportunity to rant about how quantum mechanics is all about information, and that's exactly what I'll do. It's just propagandizing. Teleportation, though, isn't something I've thought a lot about until recently. And that's just that I was sat at lunch a few weeks ago when conversation about teleportation started up, and people started arguing about whether teleportation was really, really interesting or actually completely obvious and fantastically dull, utterly meaningless. So I have my own prejudices on that front. I think teleportation is actually quite interesting, but I thought it might be useful for me, at any rate, purely selfishly, to go through my thoughts on why teleportation is actually interesting to me. Lots of reasons it's interesting to lots of people, but just go through why it's interesting to me. And this is an excuse for me to think about that, really. So thanks for the excuse. Okay. What am I going to talk about? I'm going to talk about information. So let me start immediately by start with the hard sell. Physical information is what the entire game is about. And quantum mechanics, just to contradict, possibly, I don't know how much, I really actually know very little about how much quantum mechanics you've already learned this week or before you even came here. So do tell me at some point. But quantum theory is not a fully fledged theory of the way the world works. It doesn't tell you where electrons go. It doesn't even mention that there are electrons. Quantum theory by itself doesn't allude to the fact. Doesn't talk about atoms. Doesn't talk about anything like that. Instead, it's a mathematical framework. It's a framework into which you can plug whatever little bit of physics you're talking about. So it's got a little box in which you can just write in. You can write in, I want to talk about mass, or I want to talk about charge. And all you do is you write the appropriate word in the box, press play, exact same program runs, and you get the right answer out. And there's something genuinely remarkable about quantum theory. It's a remarkable fact about many physical theories, that they show that lots of phenomena that might be thought to be unrelated are actually just different manifestations of the same thing. So, I mean, a great example of that is gravity. One of the more remarkable things about Newtonian gravity is that all of a sudden, somewhat counterintuitively, it turns out that the orbit of Venus around the sun and apples falling on people's heads is governed by the exact same set of rules. And I don't think many people would have bet that way before Newtonian mechanics was discovered. I'm not even sure Kepler would, for example. Quantum mechanics goes way further than that. It's talking about all physical information, and it's saying that every single physical system, every single fundamental physical system, be it a photon or an electron or an atom or the bonds in a chloroform molecule or a buckyball, whether you're measuring the spin of something or where it is or how much it weighs or how it's vibrating, all these properties obey the, and all these objects obey the exact same rules, the exact same set of rules. Just plug in the names and you'll get the right answer out at the end. And that's just conspiracy theory land for the way that the world is organized. There's no reason we should suspect that to be the case. So the very fact that the all these apparently very different objects are colluding to obey the same rules, and the fact that these rules are so damn odd suggests that the universe is up to something that we don't really understand. But it's probably got a good reason to be doing it. So quantum information studies these rules. It's trying to find out exactly what these counterintuitive rules that physical systems obey let us do, what they don't let us do. And perhaps by finding out what they can let us do and what they don't let us do, we'll gain some insight into why the universe would want us to do X and Y, but want to forbid us from doing Z. So, you know, if you're trying to attract money from the government to fund your research, you can start talking about what these rules let us do. You can say they let us find the prime factors of large numbers very quickly so we can crack all kinds of encryption. They let us encrypt data very securely, and the government will give you lots of money. And that's very valuable research. Or if you're slightly more inclined the way many people here are, that's just a facade, and it's an excuse in order to spend more time thinking about exactly what this universal conspiracy is all about, what quantum mechanics is actually trying to tell us about reality. But I'm talking about information. I keep using this word information. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean really the foundation of all empirical science. Again, that's a bit of propaganda. But all empirical science, all our knowledge of the world is built on measurements. It's built on studying the world, observing physical systems, basically poking them and seeing what they'll do next. And the remarkable success of science is due to the fact that if you poke enough systems to see what they do next, and you have a stroke of luck, you can come up with a general rule for how all systems of that type will behave when you poke them, which you know, will do you all well and good until someone comes around and discovers some other system that turns out to be fundamentally unpokeable, and then you'll need a more general theory. But what's measurement? What's this poking business all about? The key thing about quantum mechanics, which doubtless you've all internalized by now, is that when you poke something, it protests. It changes its state. It generally indulges in all kinds of nonsense. So what do I really mean by measurement? Let's be a bit careful about it. This is all I mean by measurement. It's a very simple little model. It's kind of semi-formal definition of what measurement is. And this is a very simple classical setting. So we're trying to measure the temperature. We're trying to measure some property of a system S. In this case, it's an unknown bath. Maybe we don't know what the liquid in the bath is. We certainly don't know what the temperature is. But we do have a thermometer, and we're going to use a thermometer to measure the temperature. So we need a system S, which is our target system that we're going to measure. We also, crucially, need a system T. And the system T has to have these properties. We have to know how it behaves. We have to know what state and condition it's in to start with, know roughly how it behaves, and know how it interacts with the system we're going to study. We need to know things like, well, when I dip a thermometer in a bath, there'll be some kind of conduction, and the temperature of the two objects will equalize. And we need to know the possible future states of our system T. So here we might say, for a fairly crudely graded thermometer, we can label the possible future states of the thermometer with these integers, 1 to 99, just degrees centigrade. When we've got that in place, we can just set up a very simple measurement procedure here to perform a temperature measurement. You prepare the system T in a known state, so you get your factory to manufacture your thermometer for you properly. And then you allow the system T to interact with the system S for some fixed time according to a known interaction. And then at the end of that, you observe the state of system T. You let system S do whatever you want. You don't care about system S anymore. You're observing the state of system T. And that's a measurement, because you can then calculate back from your knowledge of the interaction what the state of system S must have been or must be now as a result of system T having a particular value. So if the value's high, you conclude the bath was quite hot. If the value's low, you conclude the bath was quite cold. The great advantage of this is, when I portray it like that, is that thermometers don't affect baths very much. Sure, they affect them slightly. Temperatures has to equalize, so you put a thermometer in a hot bath, the bath is going to cool down, and vice versa. But they don't affect them very much, and crucially, you don't have to throw away all the bath water in order to measure its temperature. But I suspect most of the quantum measurements you've been exposed to are different. Those quantum measurements, the ones people naturally talk about, or most often talk about, seem to involve destroying the very system you're trying to measure. And this leads to some very odd language, which we can avoid. So I'm going to try and introduce you to a way to avoid it. But to give you an example here, if we take a Stern-Gerlach experiment, which you know vaguely about, where we just throw some electrons into a Stern-Gerlach apparatus, and according to their spin, and there are two detector plates here, and according, and this is going to perform a spin measurement on the electron, either leading to some detection event there or detection event there. This is said to be a measurement of the spin of the electron. So if the electron's in here, we'll say the electron was spin up, and if the electron's found there, we'll say the electron was spin down. Okay? But I actually find that language really confusing, genuinely confusing. Because what's happened is the electron has entered the Stern-Gerlach magnet in some state, some unknown state. It's gone through, been transformed, and then been destroyed on a plate. At what point exactly was the electron supposed to be in one of these two states? And why on earth are we talking about the electron having been measured in one of those two states when it's gone? It's long gone. Kind of doesn't make sense, to me at least. And yet this is the language people use. People say, well, when we measure a quantum system in a given state, if we measure a quantum system and we find it to be in a given state A, then after the measurement, its wave function says it's exactly A. It's not some A with some probability. It's exactly A with probability 1. So why does that language even make sense? And so I want to introduce you to this. This is the first thing we talk about, this idea of non-demolition measurements. Because that language can make sense, doesn't really make sense for this kind of destructive measurement. But there's something really fun you can do in quantum mechanics, predictably enough with entanglement. And you can do anything you like, any measurement you like, to a given quantum system. Even a measurement that would normally involve stabbing it with knives, setting it on fire, crushing it with spoons, anything like that. And you can do it all not to the system you want to understand, but to a proxy system. And you do it in exactly the way I just mentioned with the thermometer. You take your system S, which is the system you want to measure, say the electron whose spin you want to know, and you take system T, which is some other system whose state you already know. You obviously don't know the state of system S because that's what you want to find out. But take some system T whose state you already know. Mix them up a bit. Let them evolve according to some known interaction. Then at the end of that interaction, let system S go on its merry way, unhindered, unblown up, perfectly intact. And do all the dirty work on system T. Send system T into the Stern-Gerlach apparatus and see what happens. So using that kind of system, and you can use that kind of measurement to perform any quantum measurement you can imagine, we can perform anything, we can do anything we like to system S effectively. we can get any information that we could get by setting fire to system S, by setting fire to poor old system T instead. I'll just show you how that works for a spin measurement. Do you know, hands up anyone who knows Ket notation? Okay. Ket notation is really simple. It's about the most friendly notation you can imagine. So let me put it on this. And Ket, the word Ket just stands for the last three letters in bracket. There are also other vectors called bras, which look like this. We don't need to worry about them for today. The only vector the only thing we're interested in is a ket. That's a ket vector, or a ket. What is it? Well, it's just a way of writing a quantum state. This is what I would refer to as a quantum state. Or if you prefer to think in terms of wave functions, this is a particular state of the wave function. So what do we know about what those things are? Well, they're just really collections of complex numbers. They're vectors in a complex vector space. So for instance, this might essentially just be shorthand for some vector, some unspecified number of complex numbers, where these complex numbers are what's telling you the amplitudes of the wave function at every different energy level in the atom, or the probability with which the electron is spin up or spin down, anything like that. Ket vectors are usually, because probabilities tend to sum to one, these vectors are just vectors in complex dimensional Hilbert space. They're just complex vectors. They're of length one. And you can write anything inside a ket and get away with it. And all it means is we're describing the quantum state of a system. So in shorthand, because we don't want to go into the nitty-gritty, dirty work of specifying a ridiculous number of complex numbers. So here is a valid quantum state. It's an alive cat. Here is another valid quantum state, a slightly less happy one. It's a dead cat. These are really just shorthand for huge, huge numbers of complex numbers specifying the exact quantum state of the cat. But we don't need to worry about that because we don't need to worry about it right now. But what we can do is we can play around with these things because these vectors we can manipulate amongst themselves. For instance, we know that any two vectors we can add and we'll get another vector out. So from the superposition principle, if we have these two vectors as valid quantum states of a cat, and by observation, cats come in both these varieties, then this state is also a valid quantum state for a cat. Where alpha and beta are just some complex numbers, some unspecified complex numbers. They can be anything I like. So this is the only thing you've got to remember about kets. If I write down a ket, it's a quantum state. It's really representing a vector, and vectors just satisfy ordinary vector addition rules in complex dimensions. Stick any two together, they superpose, it's a new valid quantum state. Any questions? Okay. Any questions? No questions about cats? Okay. Anyone wants to ask about them later on, feel free, but there's going to be quite a lot of them. But all they really mean, every time I write down a ket, is just, it's a statement, the quantum state is X. So it's like, so if I write down this, that just means the quantum state is spin up. That's all it means. So with this notation, let's say, this is equal to spin up, and this is equal to spin down. And I can label these things. So that's spin up of system S. And that would be saying spin down system T, where S and T are just electrons. We can get back to performing a Stern-Gerlach measurement on S without ever actually touching it ourselves, just using entanglement. How can we do that? Well, we start with S and T here, out on one side. And we know what state T is in. We're going to prepare T in one particular state. We have to know what it is for this to work. So I'm just going to specify we're going to prepare it in state up. That's pretty arbitrary. And then we're going to combine these two systems and allow them to interact in some fashion. And what fashion are we going to allow them to interact in? We have to know the interaction. Well, we can just specify the interaction by specifying what happens to the possible states of S and T as they undergo the interaction. So for example, here's a possible state of S and T. That just means they're both up, spin up. And we can say, well, that would transform in this interaction to the state that, which just means they're both up again. Nothing happens to this state. And if we do this for all four possibilities of a complete basis in the vector space, let's get this right. That is enough to specify an interaction. This is the kind of thing that happens when you don't poke quantum systems. You just leave them to their own devices. Yeah.
Brackets for the last two.
Mm-hmm.
The last two different. So for the first two lines, they're the same after the interaction.
Yes.
Yeah. So why is that? Why is that just?
Well, that's just how I'm specifying what's happening to the system. So something is happening to the system. We're throwing it into a magnetic field whilst bombarding it left and right with loud music or something. And this is the resulting behavior of the system. This is just one way. It's going to be a convenient way here of writing down something called essentially a rotation in the vector space. So In this particular interaction, what's happening is these two states are being left by themselves. And these two states are just rotating between one another. And since we're applying this interaction for a fixed period of time, we're applying it for just enough time for this state to transform into that one, and vice versa. Okay? Right. Suppose we've done that. We then let system S go again and look at system T and chuck system T immediately through a Stern-Gerlach because we're feeling in a destructive mood. And we get, well, let's say we get a click here. Can everyone see it by drawing there or not? Ouch. Okay. Let's get a click. So we're chucking the system into the Stern-Gerlach, and it's either going up or it's going down. That's bad. And suppose we get the result up here. The question is, what does that tell us? What does that tell us about system S? Does anyone want to hazard a guess? Good guess. buys it out. Sure. Now, when you say the state of system S is up, what exactly are you talking about? And this is the subtlety.
The spin of the S must be up because gives up.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm gonna spell out the subtlety. You're quite right. But here's one state going in. That's the state before. And there's another state coming out. The state after. Which of those two are you talking about? Or are you talking about both? This one. That's definitely up. Okay. Do you know anything about this?
No.
Okay. So despite having performed a measurement, we don't know anything about what our system is going to do next. Okay. Close, but moves ago. I'll follow it through like this. We can write the state of the quantum system just as a linear superposition of the possibilities. It's the unknown quantum system is just written like this, where alpha and beta are unknown complex numbers. What happens when we chuck this state in with this state here, and they undergo this evolution, is as follows. Everything's linear in quantum mechanics. So just following standard superposition vector addition rules, this component, this up component, is going to act on this according to the way up vectors act on up vectors. But it's going to leave it completely unchanged. So the output here is going to be up, st, with probability alpha. Or with complex coefficient alpha, probability alpha squared. However, the down component of this unknown quantum state is going to do the opposite to this vector. It's going to flip it. So there'll be another component to what comes out, which is beta down for the up and down for t. So in other words, this interaction has actually entangled these two systems such that they'll now be found in the same state regardless of what measurement, regardless of where T is found. So the consequence of that is that with probability alpha, we'll get a click in the up detector, and with probability beta, we'll get a click in the down detector, which is exactly what the behavior we'd expect from a measurement of spin on system S. But we've just chucked system T through our Stern galaxy. So it's system T that's now decaying fuzzy dot on our screen, while system S is merrily heading off in some other direction. Nevertheless, what happens when, on this entangled state, we perform a measurement on the second electron to find out whether it's spin up or spin down? What happens to the first electron? It does. So it will change to match. So it's this state here, the output, that turns out to be definitely spin up after we perform the measurement. And it's this state here that actually remains somewhat unknown. If we were to perform this measurement many, 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 many times, we'd start to be able to work out what this number alpha was, because with probability alpha squared, this is going to happen. And we'd start to be able to work out something about that. So we'd be able to tell something about the magnitude of these complex numbers. We wouldn't actually be able to tell exactly what complex numbers they are ever by performing this measurement, because there's a lot of complex numbers that satisfy that equation for some value of epsilon. And so if we work out the probability of up is epsilon, then we know something about this quantum state, but we can't fix it perfectly. What we can always fix after just one run of the measurement is what's coming out the other side, which is exactly the behavior we expect of an ordinary Stern-Gerlach magnet on S, except S ain't gone. And this is called a non-demolition measurement, which is essentially using entanglement in some kind of quantum voodoo way of creating a little doll of system S, and then stabbing it with pins and chucking it through Stern-Gerlach magnets, and getting all the information you want out of system S without ever actually scratching it. And this is why it makes sense in quantum mechanics to talk about the possibility of performing a measurement on a system and having the system afterwards be in the state that you measured it to be in. Because all measurements can be performed this way. So any information you want to pull out of system S, you can pull out, and system S will chug along happily in exactly the state you found it to be in afterwards. And it's measurements of that kind, in general, that I'm going to think of, because they're the simplest in quantum mechanics, as the kind of thing that extracts information from a quantum system. Doesn't have to destroy it in the process. So given that we're not overly malicious, we won't destroy our systems in the process of measuring. What we do in the process of measuring them is poke them. And they do change by being poked, despite the fact that we never chuck this through a Stern-Gerlach apparatus. It has changed. Did anyone see that that's actually really quite odd? I'll show you why it's really quite odd. This transformation here looks for all the world as though it does absolutely nothing to system S. System S always goes from its initial state to its same state, to the same state in every single one of these transformations. Nothing seems to happen to system S at all there. And yet, we didn't touch it there for sure. We just measured system T there. And yet suddenly it's changed. What part of my analysis of the situation there was glaringly wrong? Any guesses? Exactly. It looks very much in this basis, this way I've written it, in the up and down basis, as though system S isn't being changed when it follows these rules. But in fact, system S is changing. It's being entangled with system T, which objectively changes its state and allows this measurement to take place afterwards. Okay. So this is basically what I mean by physical information. Physics is the study of measurements. It's the whole business of poking systems and seeing what they do next. And although it looks perhaps at first glance in quantum mechanics like when you poke a system, you have to destroy it, at least a large fraction of the time. And although that's what experimenters in their rather clumsy way actually wind up doing in their laboratories, you don't have to. In theory, every little bit of information you want to gain about a physical system, you can pull out without destroying it. So this is a measurement. Interact system S with another system, a known sort of reference system T. Then you kick T in whatever way you fancy and find out what state. And that tells you, because you know about the interaction, what state S is in afterwards. The proxy measurement on S. Note one important thing about this. The number of possible answers we get to these questions depends on what we did to system T. Didn't actually depend on what we did on any fundamental property of system S here. So I could easily, system S could be anything. It needn't be an electron spin at all. And yet I'm measuring whether it's in this state or that state, whatever those states represent, by performing an electron spin measurement on system T. And that's also the kind of thing that's a real red flag, that information is what's important in quantum theory. But with this style of measurement, and all measurements can be performed in this style, you can measure any physical property using a measurement that determines any other physical property. So this might be where system S is. Has it gone through the top slit, or has it gone through the bottom slit? And yet we can measure that information by, so long as the interaction is appropriate, by doing a Stern-Gerlach spin measurement on some other system. What's important is the information, not what the information's about. Okay. So if I'm going to talk about quantum mechanics, and I'm going to say it's all about information, it's all about measurements, what are good measurements to pick? What are great measurements to pick to study the real world? We tend to think of properties like position and momentum as really fundamental building blocks of the world. So the natural assumption is that we should look at those first. And in fact, I somehow bet that your introduction to quantum mechanics has revolved around the position and momentum of particles. Are they waves? Are they particles? That kind of question. And it's very fundamental. It's very important to study that and so forth. But to stir up trouble a bit, I'm going to claim this is not fundamentally at its heart what the weirdness of quantum mechanics is all about. It's not about position. It's not about momentum. It's not about wave-particle duality. It's about information. More propagandizing in case you didn't spot it. Crucially, I want to ditch position and momentum right, like hot bricks, because they're hard as hell to study. A position measurement, for example, is a huge undertaking. This is a position measurement of us right now, approximately. That's about the accuracy I can get with these figures here, southwest Ontario. But there are, in order to fix our position on the globe, even assuming we're sat on the surface of the sphere, to that level of precision, I have to distinguish between 64,800 different possible states. That's a huge number of possible states. I don't want to bother with that. As a physicist, and more to the point, as an extremely lazy physicist, I want to deal with the simplest possible system I can handle. It gets worse. If I actually want to do a position measurement to any kind of useful precision, I need better and better equipment. And the number of possible states I need to distinguish gets arbitrarily large. So this is our position right now, I reckon, approximately. I can't even count that high. But that many possible states to distinguish just to identify that we're there. Might be all very well using Google Earth, but if I'm trying to do theory with these kind of numbers, I want to stick to something simpler. So what's the simplest question I can ask that I can start doing useful and interesting things with, start looking at the physics of? What's the simplest question I can ask about the world? How many possible states? Two, exactly. The simplest bit of physical information we can ever obtain about the world is one bit, and it's just the answer to a yes-no question. Am I here or not? Is there a photon there or not? Ground state or not for the atom? Is the cat deceased, or is it happy and bouncing? Probably not happy and bouncing if it's in a box, but is it bouncing regardless? There are only two possible answers to these questions. That's the point. There's only two possible states I have to identify at the end of the procedure. And nevertheless, simply by restricting myself to questions and systems like these, I can get everything about the physical world, absolutely everything. Anyone who's ever played 20 questions knows how powerful binary questions can be. You just ask question after question after question to try and narrow down the set of possibilities from all human beings living. And very quickly, you start off, you know, halving the field with your first question. And if you keep asking clever questions, all of a sudden, you've identified someone in no time flat. Classical computation is built on this principle. Classical computers can do crazy things simply with ones and zeros. You can use them to design the architecture of buildings whose roofs leak, strangely enough. You can use them to model the aerodynamics of planes coming into land, or to model predator-prey relationships with deer and wolves. Any classical physical system you want can be modeled simply with zero and one systems. The same, remarkably, is true quantum mechanically. Any quantum mechanical system you want in the world can be modeled using yes or no questions asked of quantum systems. And that's the basis for quantum computing. We can get away. We have to replace bits with a quantum version, the qubit. But quantum mechanically, we can get away with simply looking at yes-no questions asked of the physical world, and we get the entirety of quantum theory. And I don't need to get my hands dirty worrying about where my photons are or how fast they're going. Yes-no is all I need to worry about. Is it here or not? Is it to the left or is it to the right of me? So classical bits you'll be very familiar with. All classical computation is built on this. Two possible states could be, you know, some state of a valve, some energy level in a capacitor, anything like that. Two possible answers to the question, is it charged or is it not? Is it left of me, is it not? Two possible answers. And corresponding to that, there's two possible states of the universe. Very simple. Direct one-to-one correspondence between states of the universe and answers to my question. Trivial. In classical theory, information is not that interesting. Quantum mechanics does things differently. Crucially, because of the superposition principle, although the answers to the questions I ask, like the Stern-Gallant question, are the same, up or down, questions I ask have the same set of answers, up or down, always two possibilities. Same set of answers, but a completely different set of possible states corresponding to what's giving me those answers. In fact, there's a continuous infinity of states that are providing the answers. So in contrast, quantum theory, possible states two, possible states significantly more than two. And in fact, this little object is what runs all quantum computation, and with it we can model all quantum mechanics. It's called the qubit. And it's simply a representation of the pure quantum states of a two-level system. I'm labeling the levels of the system 0 and 1 just as a hangover from classical bits. But really, you should think of 0 and 1 as any two possible answers to a physical question you can come up with. Is the photon in the left box or is it in the right box? Is the atom excited? Is the atom not excited? Is the spin up? Is the spin down? Is the photon polarized left? Is the photon polarized right? They're all obeying the exact same rules, and their information theory was all based on this qubit structure. So rather than just two points, we have a sphere of possible points between these states. The sphere is just essentially the set of complex vectors here. Essentially, it just follows the following rule. We can represent these states as cos theta plus e to the I phi sine theta 1. And that means on the sphere that if I've got some state there, its angle from the up-down axis is theta, and its angle around here, theta over 2, actually, around here is phi. And we don't need to worry about this being a complex number, because actually, it turns out that if you multiply, all we're worried about are unit vectors. But if you multiply, just as in regular real dimensional vector space, if you multiply a vector, a real vector, by a real number, you don't change the direction of the vector at all, you just get a longer or shorter vector. The same thing happens in quantum theory. If you multiply a complex vector by a complex number, you just get essentially a complex vector that's pointing in the same direction out. And all we care about is the direction of the vectors. That's what's telling us what the state is, the direction of our vectors in complex vector space. So this is a perfectly valid representation of a two-level quantum system. And the key point is, there's nothing special about our choice of these two points, 0 and 1. There might seem to be something special about them. For instance, if you have a particular fondness for cats, you might think there's something particularly special about the state 0 if it corresponds to an alive cat. But in theory, we can also ask any other measurement. We can pick any axis we like across the sphere and make that measurement. We can ask, for instance, is it 0 plus 1 or is it 0 minus 1? But we always have to ask a binary question, essentially. At least for our purposes, we always have to ask a binary question. When we can never learn exactly where this vector is directly. All we ever learn after we ask a question, is it up or is it down? We'll either get the answer, yes, it's up, or yes, it's down, because those are the only two possible answers we can get. And we'll get them with certain probabilities. We'll get the answer up with probability cos squared theta over 2, and we'll get the answer down with probability sine squared theta over 2. This squared is 1. So that's a qubit. That's all quantum information. Like I say, you can measure in any axis you like. Pick any axis, it's still valid. And this is actually the uncertainty principle straight away. We haven't mentioned delta x, we haven't mentioned delta b. Delta x, delta p is a particular example of the uncertainty principle, but this is the core of it. It's the fact that any measurement you make is a choice of an axis somewhere on the block sphere. It's a choice of some yes-no question. And if a system is in a state of definiteness as to the outcome of one yes-no question, it's automatically in a state of maximum uncertainty as to the answer of another. So for example, if we have a system in state 0 here, and we perform a 0-1 measurement, say spin up, spin down, we're automatically going to get the answer 0 out at the end, because it's spin up, we know that. But if we were to perform a spin measurement in a different direction, which is just picking a different axis, say the horizontal direction, we'd find what? We'd find that this photon gave one answer half the time and the other answer the other half of the time. We'd be maximally uncertain as to what was going to happen next. So that's the uncertainty principle immediately. Any question you ask has associated with it a host of other questions about which it's which are incommensurate, which can't be asked at the same time. You also get no cloning straight away. Qubits can't be cloned. We can't clone quantum information. Why not? Well, if we could make lots and lots and lots and lots of copies of these things, we could just keep pushing all the copies through this thing, performing different measurements each time, rotating our magnets, and acquire a vast amount of information about what the state of the system was, all without destroying our systems. So if we had lots of clones, we could actually measure the state of a quantum system directly. Which contradicts what I've just said about the way these systems work in the first place. There are only two possible answers to any measurement you perform on them, yes or no. If you could clone quantum information, you'd be able to essentially measure things without disturbing them, which is pretty non-quantum mechanical. And you'd violate the uncertainty principle to boot, because you'd be able to measure any of these axes with any of these other axes, just by doing it on multiple different clones. So how much information is there in this thing? To specify the state of the simplest possible quantum system takes an infinite amount of classical information. You've got to specify a point on the surface of the sphere. And we just saw how hard that was for planet Earth with any kind of precision. However, it can only reveal one bit of classical data. So how much information is there in it? Well, but the fact of the matter is it's a new kind of information. And that's what quantum mechanics is all about. It's not fair to study it in terms, you can't quantify how much information there is in this thing in terms of a certain number of classical bits. In some senses, it's got one bit in it. In some senses, it's got an infinite number. So simply by considering how the information, how measurement results behave, without ever actually mentioning that I'm talking about momentum, because I'm not, or energy, or polarization, or anything like that, without ever specifying that, simply considering what the information is doing, we've got quantum weirdness already. We've got non-orthogonality, we've got no coding, we've got uncertainty. And in fact, just thinking about information, without ever specifying what we're discussing, information, we'll get the full range of quantum phenomena, including entanglement, including non-locality, the full shebang. And what I'd like to discuss now is one of the full shebang in detail, which is teleportation. How much do you guys know about entanglement? A bit. Okay, I'll whip through entanglement really quickly because I don't want to tell you lots of stuff you've already been told by multiple cryptographers. Stop me if I'm going too fast. So the superposition principle works equally well whether you're dealing with two systems or one system. So if you've got two qubits instead of one qubit, there are four possible, we can ask four possible questions of them, right? Are you up, up? Are you up, down? Are you down, up? Are you down, down? And there are four possible answers. There's, corresponding to each of those possibilities. So four possible states of a two-qubit system. Linearity of quantum mechanics and the superposition principle tells us we can just stick any old complex numbers we like in front of those states, and we get a possible state of the system. In particular, for example, we could stick the complex number 1/2 in front of all those states, and we get a valid state of the system. That's a valid state of a two-qubit system, a pair of two-level systems of any kind in quantum theory. It happens to be unentangled. And you can see it's unentangled pretty easily, because regardless of what you measure system A to be, you know nothing whatsoever about system B. So in other words, they're not at all correlated. But that's not the only kind of possible state you can have. You can stick any numbers in front of these things you like. Here's a different choice, and here's a state that's maximally correlated. Whatever you measure in system A, you'll find system B to be in the same state. On the face of it, that's not that remarkable, because lots of objects have this kind of look like they have this kind of property. For instance, socks. If you are sartorially inclined, you tend to wear socks of the same color. So measurement of the sock on your left foot will correlate strongly with the color of the sock on your right foot. And so it goes. These socks behave a lot like an entangled state. If all we ever ask of the entangled state in the socks is the same old boring question, up or down, black or white. But the point about quantum theory is you can pick and choose which question to ask things, and there's a continuous infinity of possible questions you can ask. For instance, you can ask a photon, not only are you up or down polarized, but are you left or right polarized? And the fact of the matter is, if you try with socks, however many pairs of socks I give you, to correlate them so strongly that any kind of measurement you perform on the socks is going to show some correspondence between your left foot and your right foot, you're screwed. You can't do it. But quantum mechanically, we can have entangled states where for any possible question we ask, any question whatsoever we might ask system A and system B, they'll always demonstrate a correlation, even though they have no idea which question we're asking the other one. That's the remarkable thing about entanglement. Now, the other fortunate thing about entanglement is that it doesn't kill relativity, because even though we have these strong correlations, we can't signal faster than light with using them. And this is because when you measure an entangled state, sure, in some sense, you're going to collapse the wave function, and Alice is going to instantly change Bob's system when she performs a measurement on her half the entangled state. But her measurement produces an entirely random result. And so would Bob's if he were to perform a measurement. Alice can measure, but she can't control whether she gets the up result or the down result. They both occur here with probability 1 over root 2 squared, with probability 1 half. So although after she measures, she knows what Bob's system will do next, Bob hasn't got a clue. All Bob knows is what he always knew before Alice performed the measurement, that he'll get up with half and down with a half. And as far as Bob is concerned, Alice hasn't actually done anything at all. You can't tell that Alice has done anything whatsoever. So the correlations only appear when they compare notes later, and we can't signal faster than light, at least. Huzzah. So that's entanglement in a nutshell. Any questions? OK, teleportation. I'm covering teleportation because it's debatable whether it's interesting or not, and that's the first question we're going to confront. And that's interesting in and of itself, which shows my prejudice. But also because I think it exemplifies, perhaps more than any other quantum phenomenon, it supports my prejudice that information is where it's at. So the entire world is run according to information theoretic rules. Is quantum teleportation interesting? Here's why it's not. Classical teleportation is utterly trivial. Every time you pick up the telephone to chat to someone, you're teleporting the sound of your voice down the telephone line. It gets transmitted into a bit string, and then pushed out the other end as a reconstructed sound wave. And you don't go to bed at night marveling at telephones anymore. People probably did about 150 years ago. But they're pretty old hat now. 150 years ago, people didn't marvel at books and letters. And yet, monks could easily copy out a book and send it across Europe to another monastery. And that's, in a sense, teleportation. That's making a copy of some physical information and sending it across the world. In fact, that's more powerful than teleportation. Xerox machines do much more than teleportation could, because they can make multiple copies of what you want to send and send it to several people. Quantum mechanically, it's essentially what we can do, if we're very careful, and people are slowly starting to be able to do this in the simplest case, is we can build a fax machine that self-destructs after one use. Now, why on earth would we get excited about being able to do that? Isn't it wholly pointless? What could it ever be useful for? I'm going to claim it's interesting. And here's a couple of reasons I'm going to claim it's interesting. First of all, a very obvious reason. Screw classical mechanics. The world isn't classical. Xerox machines are a poor approximation of what's actually going on in the world, even though they work. So what I want to know is what the quantum stuff does. And teleportation is all about what the quantum stuff does. It's the absolute limit of what quantum stuff can achieve. Second reason, slightly more philosophical. Classically, we didn't used to think of information as being fundamentally bound up with identity. So if you're reading if you see two different copies of a newspaper containing the exact same articles, you don't get particularly surprised. They're just different objects carrying the same data. Quantum mechanically, though, things get more subtle, and teleportation is a way to investigate that. Subatomic particles are all identical, right? Which is a conspiracy in and of itself. I mean, are they different particles or not? Their information, their physical behavior, what the predictions we can make about what they're going to do next, that cannot be copied. So there's no way for a given particle, even though it's identical to everything else, that we can copy the what it's going to do nextness of it. So what matters most? Is it some kind of strange hidden serial number that's stamped on the inside of these otherwise identical particles that we can't see? Or is it what they're going to do next? Does it even make sense to think of particles which are, in their physical description, exactly identical as having hidden serial numbers somewhere on the inside? Answer, no, of course it doesn't. So here's quantum teleportation, which you've heard about before. Yep. Okay. So I'm going to go through it in perhaps a little more detail, because I want to do it explicitly so you see exactly what's going on. But here's the overview. Teleportation uses an entangled state to send qubits from A to B. If Alice wants to send any physical information here, Z, she just performs the kind of measurement we've been talking about, lets A and Z interact, then performs a measurement on them all with four outcomes. As a result of this, the entanglement collapses, and Bob's system will collapse into one of four possibilities. And then following a classical message from Alice to Bob, Bob can reconstruct the original physical state. So that's a hand-wavy way of explaining what's going on. But it might be slightly more instructive if you actually see the mathematics behind it. Let's say Alice wants to transport system Z. Let's say everything's a qubit. If everything we're worried about is two-level systems, then I don't need to worry about things being more complicated than they need be. So let's say the state of Z is given by this unknown state, which, as is often the case with unknown states, is just going to be equal to a linear superposition of unknown complex numbers. And let's say the initial entangled state for Alice and Bob is just a standard entangled state, the one you've seen a zillion times. An equal superposition of the possibilities of both particles being found in the spin state up and both particles being found in the spin state down. So that describes the states of all three particles at the beginning of the experiment, Z, A, and B. Z is not in any way entangled with B. How can we write this down? Well, we can actually rewrite that just by doing linear algebra, right? What we've got here is some state of AB, which is equal to this. That's the AB state here. And we've got some state of Z. That's the state of play in our experiment. So all we need to do is algebra 101. Just expand out these terms. And what we can get is that this is equal to start of play, 1 over root 2, alpha. So all I've done here is instead of describing A and B together inside the same thing and Z separately, I've decided that it seems fair, since Alice actually has both A and Z in her possession, that I might as well describe A and Z inside the same ket and the B state separately. But in fact, this is just the exact same state as this and this, just three different ways of writing the same thing. Let me show you a fourth way of writing this. If I can. It's equal to this. These are just four maximally entangled states of the AZ system. So A isn't actually entangled with Z, but we can nevertheless write its state as a linear superposition with complex numbers in front of these kind of systems. So I'm just going to stick 1 over 2 root 2 in front of each of these states and sum them all up. Meanwhile, Bob's system is in the following state. So this is just one long equation. This is one possible state of the physical system on the top line, and another, and another, and another. Okay. And this, if you expand out the algebra, which I won't force you to do, obviously, is exactly the same as that is. It's just another way of writing the same thing. But what this reveals is that Alice can perform a measurement that distinguishes between these four possibilities of her quantum system. She's got a two-qubit system, so she can pick any four basis vectors for the two-qubit system she likes, and then ask a four-outcome question. Is it this? Is it that? Is it that? Is it that? Irregardless of the fact that the system isn't entangled, she can ask, is it this entangled state, or that one, or that one, or that one? And the answer, of course, will be, for some of these states, one of these states, it's that one, with some probability. At which point, of course, Alice's system is entangled. Alice's system A is entangled with Alice's system Z. The entanglement, which did exist once upon a time with Bob, gets destroyed, and Bob's system is collapsed into one of these four possibilities. These four possibilities look quite similar because they look a damn sight like the original state we were trying to teleport Psi Z up at the top. So what do they actually look like? What Bob has at this point is one of four possible states. He's either got the actual one right. If the top possibility happened, he's got it right straight away. That's exactly what he wanted to have. Or he's got it slightly wrong. He's got a minus sign where there should be a plus. Or he's got the complex numbers the wrong way around. Or everything's gone wrong, including my plus sign. So he's got one of these four possibilities. What does that actually look like for Bob? Well, it looks like an equal superposition of these four completely opposite states. It looks like a mess. Bob doesn't notice that anything's happened, in fact, just as with an entangled state. But Alice knows what's happened, and Alice can tell him which of those four results she got. And when Alice tells him which of those four results she's got, it's going to take her two classical bits to send to Bob. When those two bits arrive, all of a sudden, Bob is going to have a eureka moment and say, you know, I'm not in a complete coin toss of which of these I've got. I've definitely got this one, because Alice got measurement result two. Now, the story's not quite over at this point, because although he knows he's definitely in the state corresponding to measurement result two, he has no clue what measurement result two corresponds to, because he's no idea what alpha and beta are. Nevertheless, the funny thing is he can perform a preordained rotation regardless, taking state 0 to state 0 and state 1 to stick a complex number in front, minus 1. And if he does that on the second possibility there, regardless of what alpha and beta are, he'll automatically transform this state to this one, the correct one. So on the basis of Alice's message, Bob knows what transformation he has to perform on his system to deterministically, with probability one, give him the state Alice was thinking of to start with. And that's teleportation. But I have a couple of questions, because it's not entirely obvious what's going on, perhaps. Note particularly the following. Alice, of course, deletes her quantum system in the process. When she entangles it, the system Z, with A, all the information about what it would do next gets lost. Still there in her lab, can still be there because she can perform a non-demolescent measurement. But all the information's gone. All the information's now with Bob. Alice has to learn nothing about the quantum state in the process of this procedure. Because if she did learn something, that would be gaining information that would just subtract from the information we were sending to Bob, because quantum information can't be cloned. If Bob has a perfect copy, then Alice must be left with absolutely zilch. But it's also important to note that other than having it arrive in his lab, Bob knows nothing about it either. That's okay, because owning a qubit is what we mean by having a qubit of information. He's got it there. But he doesn't know what alpha is, and he doesn't know what beta is. All he knows is that he has the object, and he can perform measurements on it at his leisure. So here's the question. Does Bob know when Alice has performed her measurement and collapsed his state? No, he doesn't. It's the exact same situation as with entanglement before. With an entangled state, if Bob's sharing half of an entangled state, then his local measurements are perfectly random. And all the information about measurements is contained in the correlations between measurements, none in the individual outcomes. And it's exactly the same. Even though Bob's system is not entangled, it's exactly the same when it's in a mixture, when it's in one of these four states with probability 1/4 each. And you can see that's true, because if it's in this state with probability 1/4, and that with probability 1/4, that with probability 1/4, that with probability 1/4, then the probability of him getting a naught outcome is just essentially alpha squared, complex numbers, but what the hey, plus alpha squared, plus beta squared, plus beta squared, all multiplied by 1/4, 1/2 root 2, courtesy this coefficient. But that's squared, so 1/8. And what's that? Well, alpha squared plus beta squared is equal to 1. So that's 1/4. Alpha squared plus beta squared is equal to 1. So that's just 2 inside the bracket from normalization. That's 1/4. So the probability of getting outcome naught is equal to 1/2. It's just as if he's still got the original entangled state. He can't tell the difference between B being entangled with A and B being in one of these four possible states, like so. So the question you have to ask yourself is, if Bob can't, even in theory, distinguish between these two different conditions with perfect measurements, has anything really happened in his laboratory? Does something strange happen when Alice's measurement arrives? Sure. Sure. Do you think that's a physical process? What would happen if Bob opened the door before the message arrived, and then Alice's measurement arrived? Well, it's worth noting, okay. It's a slightly tricky question for me to ask, because in this protocol, Bob actually doesn't measure his photon at all. It's worth spotting. Crucially, whether Bob opens it early or not does not affect the story. If Bob were to open it early, he would subsequently find, when a message arrived from Alice, that Alice had been telling him something that was entirely consistent with his observations so far. But if he had to guess which state the system was in beforehand, he's got no chance of guessing. So he might guess wrong. Subsequently, he'll find out he guessed wrong, and Alice's measurement arrives and he kicks himself. Second question. There's only 3 questions. How much information about the quantum state is contained in Alice's classical message? Sending 2 bits of quantum of classical information across the ether from Alice to Bob. Suppose I were to intercept that message how much information would I get about system Z? Anyone got a guess? Sure.
Well, you've got enough to distinguish between the four possible states that you don't handle after data.
Okay, so about 2 bits worth, or you got some, but not everything.
Right.
Okay. Absolutely none is the correct answer, which is very strange. Remember, Alice's measurement on this system here, it's just a projection measurement, and the amplitudes of each of these states are equal. They're all the same. So each outcome occurs with equal probability. So that measurement is just generating a completely random pair of bits. And that's utterly independent of the actual quantum state that's being teleported. So the classical message is purely random. Of course, if there was any information about the state in the classical message, Alice would have it immediately. And Alice can't know anything. Otherwise, we've partially cloned the state, because Bob is going to know everything at the end. Bob is going to have a perfect copy. So Alice has to know nothing. The classical message must contain nothing about the state. Slightly odd, while the message is in transit, Bob's system is maximally mixed. It looks as though nothing's happened to it. The classical message is perfectly random, contains no information about what's going on. And Alice's system is destroyed. Or not destroyed, but rendered useless as a result of her measurement. So if this is teleportation, what on earth is happening to the thing we're teleporting at that point? Where's it gone? It's a real object. This is the real world. Where on earth is it? I'll leave you to think about that. Last question. Just quickly. Ballast strike sent half an entangled system to Bob. Could the entanglement survive the procedure? So she's got two entangled particles, but she's only going to send one to Bob, and she's going to hang on to one herself. Is entanglement going to survive, or is it going to be destroyed by teleportation? Yeah, it's the entangled particle, she's saying. So this kind of description of the particle, alpha plus beta, kind of independently, or is wrong. It's actually half an entangled system, and there's some fourth system we're not mentioning. Is the entanglement going to survive? Make your own minds up and then see that the answer is?
Yes.
It gets through fine. No problems, no hiccups whatsoever. And in fact, this is what people tend to use when they're performing teleportation experiments to prove it's been a success. They teleport an entangled particle, and then after it's got through, they prove that the entanglement still exists. Because if entanglement survived after teleportation, you know for a fact you did something quantum mechanical, you sent some of the quantum information. So just to wrap up, I'm a theorist, I know nothing about this kind of thing. But these are the kind of things people have so far managed to teleport between. They can do optical fibers with high fidelity, optical fibers and photons, basically the best thing you can use to teleport objects, but it's been done. You can teleport in sequence, right? I mean, the crazy thing about this is system B, that's just acquired the state of system Z, never met system Z at all. They have a mutual friend in system A, but they never ever met. In fact, they can come from different ends of the universe, just coming towards each other. And as soon as their light cones share a mutual past with some kind of mutual association with system A, then suddenly we get perfect transmission of identity from one system to another. Even though they've never met. It gets worse. You can actually just chain that. So that two systems that are simply friends of friends of friends of friends of friends and friends can perfectly exchange information as soon as there's a chain of relationships, as soon as there's some chain of entanglement between them. And that is the second thing, sequential teleportation. We can even do friend of a friend teleportation successfully, reasonably successfully. That's a pretty poor measure of success, seeing as 0.5 is would be no success at all. But it's better than nothing. The biggest thing we've teleported successfully in a comprehensive way is 2 qubits. This is one qubit teleportation, we can do two. Not quite Spock yet. But we can do strange things, like we can teleport the state of a photon onto the ionization level of a cesium atom, or vice versa. And we can actually teleport quite massive things. We can teleport beryllium atoms from A to B. So here are just two pretty pictures. You can see lots of photons there, whirling around in Geneva. Geneva are generally the people who use optical fibers, but they're clearly not bothering there, getting in the way. Optical fibers probably slightly darker. And in Innsbruck, they play around with atoms, and clearly there are a lot of atoms in that picture. I'll skip that. You can do... Oh, yeah, sure.
Let's say we have the information that Alice gets from her measurement, she now will make additional things. She just somehow makes it different than it was before, and now sends it to Bob. So therefore, the system that arrives at Bob would be something entirely different than was sent before. That would create something that has existed before out of nothing.
That's true. If Alice lies to Bob, then Bob does not get the original system. He gets a system that's directly related to the original system. It's like an evil twin, or an evil quadruplet. But it's not the original system. But this is a well-known danger of science fiction teleportation.
And we could also use this,
Well, Bob has to have a qubit to start with to imprint on. And Alice is destroying the information in the process of sending it. Alice can pick what she wants to send to Bob to a certain extent. But she's not creating something out of nothing. She's just making a choice between different messages to send to Bob, different quantum messaging. I just skip on to the end quickly, seeing as I'm out of time. You can encrypt crazy strongly with teleportation. Even if the eavesdropper herself is the one who hands you the entangled state to start with, and she can't be trusted to be giving you what you think she's giving you, you can still send quantum information unconditionally securely using teleportation. And you shout the classical message to high heaven, and it can't be intercepted because you're shouting so loud, and it doesn't matter that everyone hears you, because it's unrelated to what you're sending with the qubit. Here's the conclusion. What is quantum information after all? That's what these strange counterintuitive questions about teleportation have been trying to address. What on earth is this quantum state we're teleporting all about? Is it really this physical thing that's collapsing? Or is it just some suspicion in everyone's mind as to what's actually going to happen next? So this is Asher Peres, who's a very distinguished Israeli physicist. One of the founders of quantum information theory and one of the discoverers of teleportation. And I'll give him the last word. When asked whether it was possible to teleport the soul as well as the body, exactly the kind of question you expect journalists to ask you when you give your discovery such a buzzword as teleportation. Is it possible to teleport the soul as well as the body? His response is only in soul. Thank you very much.
A little bit behind, but let's take maybe just a couple of questions, and then you have your mentors outside. Okay, one question.
If you like, can I have like Adrian's particles? And I made a quantum sphere of data out of everything you compose, and I only send half of it to Bob.
And you only send half of the classical message.
Well, no, I only send half of the quantum information to Bob.
Okay.
So it's essentially regarding with how second question. So finally sent half the information. How can all the information get through if he only has half the information that he can trust?
The only thing that gets sent directly is classical information. Okay. So if you're talking about sending half, that sounds a lot like you're sending half the bits, or sending essentially. In which case, no, Bob can't reconstruct Adrian with half the bits. He can narrow down the possibilities, and what you'll get is an extremely gooey mess of chaotic mush. Alice is to blame for such malicious behavior. But Alice still has the information. So in theory, if she were to send it in stages, Bob could slowly accumulate it.
Right.
And yet, whilst this procedure is going on, whilst the information is slowly trickling along, where is Adrian? He's going to emerge at the end of the triple, when all the information gets to Bob. In the meantime, he's not in the classical data, he's not with Bob, and Alice hasn't seen him since she performed her measurement.
So let's thank Jonathan again.